Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from London. Today, fears of an all-out conflict between Russia and the West are being stoked by developments on multiple fronts. Russia has accused six British diplomats of spying, and it stripped them of their credentials. News of the diplomats' expulsion comes on the day that Britain's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is due to meet President Biden at the White House. They're expected to discuss Ukraine's demands for more Western weapons, including the UK's Storm Shadow missiles. The White House meeting comes less than a day after President Putin warned Western governments not to let Ukraine target Russia with Western arms, saying that because NATO military personnel would have to program the missiles' flight paths, such a move would drag the country supplying Kyiv into the war. Poland's Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski told the BBC that the West could not trust Vladimir Putin and should not be intimidated by him.
It's very difficult what to make of President Putin's words because he is such a liar. He lied that it wasn't his forces that did the Anschluss of Crimea. He lied that he had absolutely no intentions of invading Ukraine. And then he drew these red lines at every stage of our assistance to Ukraine. The supply of tanks, the supply of aircraft, these nuclear threats. He's lost credibility and therefore we don't know whether he means it.
So, are things different now? Are President Putin's threats credible? I spoke to the BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner.
Well, it comes at a time of increasing tension, at a fairly critical juncture in the Ukraine war, and the fact that Ukraine is making a very strong case in the interest of its own self-defense rather than attacking, rather than going on the offensive. It wants to be able to hit the Russian bases from which aircraft launch these horrific glide bombs that are devastating its cities. But the truth is, and I think it's probably time for a bit of a reality check here, Ukraine doesn't have that many of these Storm Shadow missiles. Britain hasn't got that many more to give. And the fact is that the Russians have already predicted that a decision could well be taken on this to allow Ukraine to use them, and they've moved a large amount of their equipment, their aircraft, their ammunition stores further back into Russia beyond the range of Storm Shadow missiles.
But beyond that, I mean, is American permission needed for Ukraine to use the UK's Storm Shadow missiles? If not, why is it seemingly being sought?
There's two aspects to this, the technical and the political. On the technical side, US intelligence is integral in terms of planning and targeting, and it has been for a very long time. That isn't really going to change anything. US intelligence is been working, as has British intelligence, closely with the Ukrainians right since even before the very first day of this war, but intensively ever since February 2022. So that doesn't really change things. Ukraine has got Patriot missile batteries on the ground in Ukraine. Those certainly at some stage have required technical assistance from NATO personnel. That's not the same as putting combat troops on the ground, but in order to operate those systems, yeah, to some extent, you need Western expertise. So that's not going to change anything. But then you've got the sort of the big escalation side of this, because if Russia perceives that it is under attack from long-range Western missiles, crewed, whether or not it's true or not, but crewed, as in C-R-E-W-E-D, by Western defense personnel, that is perceived as an escalatory step which threatens how is Putin going to respond. It's very unlikely he's going to resort to tactical nuclear weapons. Everyone's warned him not to, including China. But there are other things he could do to make life uncomfortable for the West.
Security correspondent Frank Gardner. So what exactly are storm shadow missiles, and what difference would they make on the battlefield? Dr. Marina Myron is a weapons analyst from the Department of War Studies at King's College London.
Storm shadow missiles are cruise missiles, meaning that they don't fly like ballistic missiles according to the ballistic trajectory, which is sort of a half circle. They fly much closer to the ground and they can maneuver in order to evade air defenses. So it makes the likelihood of them hitting the target much higher, and they are more difficult to intercept. And specifically, storm shadows are designed to destroy hardened targets, meaning when the missile penetrates the target, it explodes. So making sure that the target is eliminated completely rather than explode just upon hitting the target. And probably one of the more important points is that they are launched from the air. So you would need something like an F-16 in Ukraine's case, or the adapted version of the Soviet Su-24 in order to launch these missiles.
Take us through, what difference would it make to Ukraine if it gained permission to use these missiles?
I think it would boost the morale and reinforce the ties between Ukraine and Western partners, because there is a lot of trust. And also, Ukraine would need to be supplied with targeting data, because Ukraine doesn't have its own satellite capabilities. So it would have to rely on Western partners for that. The problem is that as far as a battlefield configuration is concerned, it might not change that much, because firstly, as I said, Ukraine would have to use the F-16s to deliver these missiles, and F-16s, they can be subject to Russia's ground-based air defenses, meaning that they can be shot down. So there is a risk. The second part of this, how many missiles does Ukraine have? Because each of these missiles is about 2 million pounds, meaning that they're very expensive. How expensive are they in relation to the targets that are being destroyed?
So, Marina, it sounds like you're not thinking that these missiles would really make that much of a difference for Kyiv. Is it really just down to a big morale boost?
I think it's mostly down to the big morale boost, because in order to make it count, Ukraine would need to have many more of these deep strike systems, not just including Storm Shadow and Scalp missiles, but also the likes of German Taurus missiles, in order to be able to strike much deeper into Russian territory on the one hand. And on the other hand, they would have to support these strikes with ground maneuver. And we have seen during the counteroffensive last year, the Ukrainian forces didn't master this skill very well. And if we look at the history of how NATO uses such deep strikes, these are always supported with ground maneuver, which Ukraine would have to do, meaning that it wouldn't really change that much.
So presumably then they need more missiles, American missiles perhaps.
Not just more missiles, they also need the ground capabilities. They need ground forces capable of conducting combined arms operations.
Dr. Marina Myron from King's College London. So the North African state of Tunisia now, a leaked report drafted by the European Union, shows the bloc is increasingly worried about the crushing of dissent inside the country. The report details what it describes as a clear deterioration of the political climate and a shrinking civic space under the president, Kais Saied, in power since 2019. At the same time, the EU is trying to protect its interests. It's acting to preserve a migration deal with Tunis. Hussein Bayoumi is an officer with Amnesty International covering North Africa. I asked him to describe the current situation inside Tunisia.
At this time, the situation in Tunisia is very bleak. What we are seeing is that since President Kais Saied suspended the constitution and since then he has cracked down on judicial independence, he has restricted media freedom, went after civil society, arrested many critics, journalists, human rights defenders and activists, accusing all of them of being foreign funded and trying to undermine Tunisian government. Of course, the president, therefore, now he is the one that gets to choose the composition of the electoral commission. And as a result, the commission bans most presidential contenders from running against him. In 2023, he has give an infamous speech where he incited against black migrants and refugees in the country. After his speech, we saw an unprecedented wave of violence against black migrants and refugees in the country.
What about the European Union's relationship with the Tunisian government? Why is this such an important relationship for the EU?
After the revolution in 2011, the EU saw Tunisia as a shining example when it comes to democratization in the Middle East and North Africa, and has invested in expanding ties and cooperation with the country. After the speech, which I have mentioned, which forced black migrants and refugees to leave the country to escape from the violence, you see the Tunisia, the European Union, pushing for a cooperation agreement with Tunisia, which expands or improves its border management and interception capacities and capabilities to basically ensure that it prevents going or reaching European shores.
Why does this matter for the European Union, particularly when it comes to migration?
Most of the migration route was from Libya, not Tunisia. Now, you see the spike in the number of people arriving to Europe through Tunisia. So from the European Union point of view, by giving money and equipment to the Tunisian authorities, it will be able to block people from going to Europe and therefore prevent them from seeking asylum, empowering security forces that are quite abusive. And knowingly, when people are intercepted and returned to Tunis, they are subjected to violations. In some of the most horrific photos, we saw how Tunisian authorities would let them to die in the desert.
Is it correct to say that this situation inside Tunisia puts the European Union in a bit of a difficult spot? Because it relies on the Tunisian authorities to keep migration numbers under control, but it also has to address its own quite high human rights standards.
Ultimately, the issue with Tunisia, it's a political problem. The authorities right now are the ones that have instigated this wave of violence, that have led people to go and leave the country and escape towards Europe. It is the government that's taking very disastrous economic decisions that is undermining the country's economic stability. And therefore, it is the government that's actually pushing people to go towards Europe. When the EU's response is to simply strengthen this government, basically hope that it will be able to contain people for the foreseeable future, then this is a policy that's doomed to fail.
Amnesty International's Hussein Bayoumi. Stay with us. Lots more to come on NewsHour. Coming up, we hear about the return of a practice in Russia which was common in Soviet times.
People who didn't live in those times suddenly act as if they did. Suddenly they are squealing on others. It is a Soviet practice, but it's also something about the Russian genetic code of fear, of trying to protect themselves at the expense of others.
You'll hear that in about 15 minutes' time. Other stories we're covering this hour. China has fined the global accounting firm PwC and told it to suspend operations in the country for 6 months over its failure to identify problems with the collapsed property developer Evergrande. And financial police in Italy say they've broken up a gang smuggling large numbers of fake vintage video game consoles. This is NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service. Well, scientists have solved the mystery of what caused an unusual seismic signal detected around the world in September last year. The signal carried on for 9 days. This is a sound version of what they were seeing. Take a listen. Dr. Stephen Hicks of University College London is one of the earthquake scientists who discovered the seismic wave and worked out what was going on. So what did he make of it at first?
On the 16th of September last year, we saw a very unusual signal coming in on our seismic monitoring stations worldwide. And we looked at one of these data points and we thought, OK, it's just an artifact locally in that station, some air pressure change or something like this. We got in contact with people running other similar monitoring stations and they saw exactly the same thing. So we were like, well, what is this? It looks nothing like an earthquake.
And so how did you locate the source of this strange new sound?
From the seismic signal, we knew roughly where it was coming from in East Greenland, but not exactly where. We still didn't know what mechanism was causing the signal. So we got in contact with colleagues in Denmark. Obviously, Greenland is a Danish territory. And those colleagues have done a lot of field work in Greenland. And they'd actually received reports of a major tsunami in one of the fjords. So that gave us the exact location. But we still had to do further work to figure out why that seismic signal is propagating all over the world over 9 days. And what that needed was a really detailed simulation to show how the tsunami wave evolved over those 9 days. And that required a very detailed map of the fjord to understand the geography and geometry of the seabed beneath the fjord. And once we made that unprecedented scale of simulation, that then showed that the height of those tsunami waves decayed in a similar way to the height of the seismic ground motions propagating around the world. And that was when we thought, all right, we've cracked it.
Okay, so describe then what happened to lead to this very unusual phenomenon.
So we know from satellite images that there was a landslide in the fjord. So there's a mountain 1.5 kilometres high above the waters of the fjord. And at the bottom of that mountain is a glacier plunging steeply into the fjord below. Now, that mountain was previously being held up by that glacier, but this glacier had thinned. It had melted by about 30 metres over the last couple of decades. So that glacier was no longer able to prop up that mountain. So it collapsed and then a huge amount of material down onto the glacier beneath it, churning up the ice, destroying part of that glacier, and made a big splash in the fjord. It's the first landslide we've ever detected from East Greenland. It seemed before that this region was immune to these sort of climate change triggered catastrophic events, but maybe for the first time East Greenland's reached a state of criticality where it's going to become unstable and produce many more of these type of events in the future.
You know, luckily there were no cruise ships in that fjord at the time.
Yes, very fortunate. I don't think any kind of vessel would have survived a 200 meter high wave. There was a cruise ship just down from the fjord, but where there was still a big tsunami wave. It was down the fjord one day before and one day after this event. So these are tourist cruise ships, but these areas can be very risky to travel to. For me, what it shows is that normally when we think about climate change impacts, we look up to the atmosphere and think about weather patterns shifting around the world at different places. But maybe for the first time to study climate change impacts, we're looking at the ground beneath our feet. This event vibrated the entire Earth. No piece of ground beneath our feet was immune to that. And it travelled from the Arctic to Antarctica in less than an hour.
Dr. Stephen Hicks from University College London. Let's turn to China now and a question. Is it possible for a sport like football or soccer to improve an entire region's economy using only local players as the stars on the pitch? Well, that's what seems to be happening in the remote mountains of southwestern China, where a competition between villages has captured the attention of the entire nation. Spectators have been drawn to the mix of musical performances beside the field and enthusiastic displays on the pitch, boosting tourist revenue by nearly 75%. The BBC's Stephen McDonnell reports from Guizhou.
Tongmen has a mixture of traditional wooden structures and newer but still pretty modest concrete buildings which are multi-stories high. People here live cheek by jowl, and during the day they sit outside on little plastic chairs, chatting with one another, telling stories, sharing something to eat, and having a laugh. Now, on the face of it, they might not have that much, but today their team is in the village football final.
It has improved our economic prospects, like for vendors where families have small businesses. It has increased their income.
Chen Yang is a 32-year-old hospital maintenance worker who plays for Dongmen Village. He says his parents hated him playing football when he was a kid, but that now they're total converts to the Guizhou Village Super League.
They didn't let me play. They threw away my sneakers. But now they have set up a store at the gate to the stadium, selling ice creams.
Since last year, a competition between villages in this part of Guizhou province has attracted millions of big city tourists who've been pouring money into the economy here. Images of the raucous, fun-filled matches have gone viral on social media, with fans like Pan Wenge cheering from the sidelines wearing traditional clothing.
When we watch the game, it's so exciting. We are really nervous. You feel your heart pumping. And when we win, we are so happy. We sing and dance.
On a hot summer night, it's a packed crowd here for the final. People don't seem to mind so much what the result is. I mean, sure, they're really cheering for their village to win, but it's all in a pretty friendly spirit, with both teams getting cheered on. Because after all, they know their local heroes are also part of their local community. They're the farmers, the shopkeepers, the students, their neighbours. So even if they are from another village's team, you can still cheer them on.
Wu Jinfu has just finished high school. The son of itinerant labourers playing in the final for Dengsheng Village still can't believe that thousands of fans have turned out to see him and his mates on the field.
When I started playing footy, I didn't expect it to be like this. I didn't expect us to have such an amazing football atmosphere.
According to officials, the hype around the Guizhou Village Super League has led to more than 4,000 new businesses registering in the region, creating thousands of new jobs. It certainly doesn't mean that everyone has suddenly become rich, but in just over 12 months, the place has transformed. The town of Rongjiang has a population of less than 300,000, yet these days, the streets around its small stadium are filled with stalls selling all manner of goods on game day. And the real action is on the inside. When the final comes to an end, Lu Jinfu has scored 2 goals, helping his younger, faster Dengsheng Village claim the win.
My teammates and I have played together since primary school. We are like brothers.
However, Shen Yang's team also got a prize for coming second, as he tells us with a big smile.
We won 2 pigs. That's not bad.
Football competition losing side Shen Yang, ending that report from Guizhou, from Stephen McDonnell.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution...
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Tens of thousands of workers at the U.S. airplane manufacturer Boeing went on strike this morning after rejecting a proposed deal that included a 25% pay rise. It's the latest setback to the company, which is already struggling with losses following a number of safety incidents. John Strickland is an aviation industry analyst.
This strike represents a key part of the company's workforce, that is, the people who actually work on the production lines, so the machinists, the engineers who produce the aircraft which are supplied to the world's airlines. And I think the fact that we've seen such a unanimous vote, 97% in favour of the strike, tells a lot about the strength of feeling. I don't personally believe this is simply about pay, but it reflects an emotional disconnect between the management of the company and the workforce.
So emotions are running high. This comes at a time when Boeing is already facing a mountain of problems. Can you take us through some of those challenges?
Well, the list is enormous. Of course, we had the unfortunate, the tragic crashes of two MAX aircraft some years back now that had led to groundings of that type and temporary production stops. Then the pandemic hit, that further disrupted production. And indeed, during that period, a lot of experienced workforce was lost. And of course, more recently, we had another incident at the beginning of this year with the door separating in flight from an Alaska Airlines 737 that led to further regulatory scrutiny. All of these factors have led to massive restriction in production and delivery backlogs, and the strike of this magnitude will simply add salt to the wounds of that problem.
Can you tell us more about what that strike will mean for the airline industry and for frustrated air travelers?
Well, airlines are waiting all over the world for aircraft to be delivered. And this isn't just a Boeing problem, but given that Boeing is one of the two leading manufacturers in the world, that means any delays it has affects an enormous number of customers across the globe. And airlines, of course, have to plan their timetables, not only months, but up to a year ahead. They have to base those decisions about what they're going to fly, what they're going to put on sale, on the number of aircraft they expect to have in their fleet. So we could have our flights disrupted. We could also find, in some cases, prices edging higher because capacity is very tight relative to the level of current demand.
So travel headaches in the future for a lot of people. We should note that the current contract between Boeing and the workers' unions was reached in 2008 after an 8-week strike. What are the prospects for the current strike to drag on for a similar period of time?
The strength of feeling would suggest that this is going to hold hard, that the willingness to strike. Having said that, the company has put out a pretty quick statement of its recognition of that strength of feeling and its desire to get back around the table. And it comes at a time when Boeing has just had on board a new CEO, Kelly Ortberg. He's already met workers on the production line, which itself is a very positive step. There's got to be the sleeves up hard haggling, but there's also got to be a winning of minds to get the workforce and the management singing off the same hymn sheet.
Aviation industry analyst John Strickland. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you live from our studio in London. Let's focus back to events in Russia now. Ever since the Kremlin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, there have been widespread reports of Russians reporting fellow citizens to the police for anti-war views, often leading to prosecution and, in some cases, prison sentences. It's revived memories of the Soviet past when informing on colleagues and neighbors was actively encouraged. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has been meeting some of those caught up in this new wave of denunciations.
Handcuffed, a doctor is led into a Moscow courtroom and locked in a cage. Her name is Nadezhda Buyanova. She's 68. She's a paediatrician, and she's on trial for spreading false information about the Russian army. She faces up to 10 years in prison. I managed to ask Nadezhda what she makes of this. I've read about this kind of thing happening to others, Nadezhda replies through the glass. I never imagined it would happen to me. It's happening because of this woman, a patient's mother. She claims that the doctor told her Russian soldiers in Ukraine are legitimate targets. She was furious. Her ex-husband had been killed fighting in Ukraine. She denounced Nadezhda to the police. That word, danos, denunciation, you hear it often now in Russia. Oleg Orlov experienced it firsthand. The human rights activist was denounced over an anti-war article he'd written. He was jailed for 2.5 years, but freed early in a prisoner swap. He's no longer in Russia. The machine of repression is working like in Joseph Stalin's time, Oleg tells me in a video call. There's no rationality to it. Now it's repression for the sake of repression. One of Stalin's ministers praises a boy who has denounced his own father as an enemy of the people. Denunciation was actively encouraged under Stalin. The gulag was full of victims who'd been snitched on by fellow citizens. Nina Khrushcheva is professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She can see that today, Russians are having no problem turning the clock back.
What I find really remarkable is how quickly Russian genetic memory has come back. How people who didn't live in those times suddenly act as if they did. Suddenly they are squealing on others. It is a Soviet practice, but it's also something about the Russian genetic code of fear of trying to protect themselves at the expense of others.
And it is Russia's war in Ukraine which is fueling this. Not only through repressive new laws aimed at silencing dissent, but by turbocharging here the hunt for internal enemies, for traitors. It's in this atmosphere of us against them that you get students informing on teachers, professors on students, parishioners on priests. And 400 miles north of Moscow, neighbour on neighbour. Hairdresser Anna Alexandrova had fallen out with her neighbour, Irina, over a plot of land in their village. Their feud led to Anna being reported to the police for posting anti-war messages. She denies sending them, but she's on trial now for spreading fake news about the army, and she faces up to 15 years in prison. This began as an ordinary domestic squabble, Anna's defence lawyer, Anastasia Pilipenko, tells me. But the so-called political articles of the criminal code have become a useful way of resolving problems between neighbours. Some Russians aren't just writing denunciations. They're taking the law into their own hands. On a Moscow bus, 87-year-old Dmitry Grinchy is attacked by two men who claim they've just heard him make insulting comments about Russian mercenaries fighting in Ukraine. Shocking mobile phone video shows the pensioner having his arms twisted behind his back, then being dragged off the bus and frog-marched to the police. He wasn't charged, but the incident has left the pensioner shaken and angry. The Russian constitution says that everyone has the right to free speech, Dmitry tells me. Why should others get to say what they think and not me? In his flat, Dmitry shows me old photos of his father, Pavel, who in 1937 was arrested and then executed, one of the many innocent victims of Stalin's terror. History never repeats itself exactly. But what is happening today is reviving ghosts of the past, with Russia once again searching for enemies and traitors, and Russians being encouraged to join the hunt.
That from our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. Well, to Nigeria now. Authorities in Borno State say up to 2 million people have been affected by floods which have swept across the northeast region of the country. At least 30 people have already been killed. The downpours follow the collapse of a dam earlier this week during heavy rainfall. Nigerian soldiers and emergency workers have been using boats and trucks to rescue people stranded by the waters, whilst the UN has been distributing food in several makeshift camps. The BBC spoke to survivors in the state capital, Maiduguri.
We left my husband behind when we had to cross a bridge. We don't know whether he was able to leave and got to safety, because he is blind. In this camp, they cook food, but we don't get it.
The flood started around dawn. We'd blocked where the water was coming with bags of sand, but the water eventually forced its way. The water started flowing into our house and it got to my chest. I have 17 kids and 14 are here with me.
The BBC's Azizat Olalua is in Maiduguri. We've just heard from some displaced residents. I asked her what others have told her.
People have been complaining, basically, especially the displaced people since they got to camp. Many of them are complaining about lack of food. You know, they only get one portion of meal a day, and most of them have not even been assigned where to sleep. As of yesterday evening, authorities were still setting up tents for thousands of these people, and many more people are still going to at least four settlement camps that the government has set up. People across the city are worried, and they say that they have relatives, because you know Borno people, just like Nigerians, are communal, so they are worried that this may worsen the situation of the country, especially the health emergency that authorities are already concerned about.
Mm-hmm. And with regards to the collapse of the dam, were there warnings it could be at risk?
Absolutely. And no, this is one mistake that authorities are reeling with that right now. Everybody is trying to shift blame, because residents living close to the dam raised an alarm. There were official complaints as well that representatives of the state government were said to have gone there to assess the situation, and they just said that there was no cause for alarm until the heavy rainfall impacted on the fence of the dam, and it now gave way, collapsed eventually. It's been an issue, not this year, but for many years, really, because there was a time that they told the federal government to rehabilitate the dam, because it's actually under the control of the national government of the country. So the governor, Babagana Zulum, told me that lack of maintenance by the national water resources led to this. But this time around, they will not allow it to happen anymore. But what can we say? Too little, too late.
The BBC's Aziza Olalua in Maiduguri. An American ultra-endurance cyclist Wednesday claimed a new world record as the fastest woman to travel around the globe by bike. Lael Wilcox crossed 21 countries on four continents before arriving back in Chicago 108 days after setting off. Her journey of more than 29,000 kilometres shaved 16 days off the previous woman's record. My colleague Paul Henley got the chance to interview her earlier and asked about her route.
So I started in Chicago. The first stretch was to New York City, and then flew from there to Portugal, then crossing Europe, across Turkey to Georgia, flew to Australia, across Australia, then to New Zealand, took the ferry to the North Island, and then from there flew to Alaska, and then south again through Canada, the west coast of the U.S., and then up the Route 66 back to Chicago.
Wow, what a trip. Presumably, if you do a requisite number of kilometers on land, then that fits within the record attempt.
So there's a list of rules. It's a minimum of 29,000 kilometers. You have to either ride east or west, crossing two opposite sides of the globe. So for me, that was Spain and New Zealand. And then you can't quite zigzag, so going one direction or another.
Does it remove some of the fun that you can never relax, that you can never be a tourist?
Oh, I mean, I felt like I was a tourist the whole time. You know, from the bike, it's like it's such a good pace to see the world. And I actually invited people from all over the world to come ride with me. Sometimes they'd come for 5 minutes or sometimes they'd stay for the whole day. It was such a fun way to share the adventure.
Well, they clearly didn't slow you down. Tell me about some of the highs and lows of the journey.
Oh, man. So, I mean, I rode through winter in Australia and New Zealand. So even seeing some snow in New Zealand, and it was pretty cold and pretty dark. But there were such kind people there, even folks coming out in the dark just to cheer me on.
You see a lot of nature up close. Tell me about that.
So many animals, bears in Canada and kangaroos and wombats and deer. And I even ran over a groundhog. And I
did it survive
every time. It did. And I didn't crash.
Well done.
So that was a win.
And tell me, how do you maintain morale? There must have been down moments.
Honestly, sometimes I'd feel like, oh, I just wish I could ride faster right now. Or I wish I didn't have such a strong headwind. But there's always going to be a high moment and a low moment in every day. And then just kind of making it to the next one kept me going.
Did you think you'd break the record?
I really hoped I would. I set a goal for myself of 110 days, but it's so hard to know if that's even possible from the outset. But I stayed really disciplined, and I knew if I could do that, I would break the overall record.
That was the American ultra-endurance cyclist Lael Wilcox speaking to my colleague Paul Henley. And I urge you to go onto the BBC News website. You can read more about Lael's story, and you can also see some great photos from her journey. Lots more to come on NewsHour on the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. The Amazon region is experiencing one of the worst droughts on record. Many rivers have dried up, temperatures have hit record highs, and in many parts of Brazil and other countries who share the Amazon, firefighters are battling wildfires. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil says the drought is directly linked with climate change. This week, in response, he announced plans to change Brazil's climate change policy. Earlier, I spoke to Christine Holverson, Director of Programs with the Rainforest Foundation US, who was currently in the Amazon. I asked her to describe the scene around her.
I'm in Pucallpa, which is a town in the Peruvian Amazon near the border of Brazil. I'm here for a meeting of indigenous leaders and allies talking about protection of indigenous peoples and voluntary isolation. Every day here, when we wake up and throughout the day, the sky, the sun is red, the sky is full of smoke, it's hazy, and it's intensely hot, and it really makes the climate crisis real. And the stories we've heard of people coming from their villages to attend the meeting have been really intense, talking about dried up riverbeds, difficulty of navigation, change in weather patterns and how they can plant their crops, and how all of this accumulates and has an impact on their villages and on their ways of life, on food security.
Christine, is there a real sense that this year in particular is unusual, that this represents a real change from the past?
Yeah, we're hearing that both from the indigenous people who are attending this meeting, but also from what we've been reading from scientists who are saying that the Amazon experiencing the worst fire season in the past 19 years, the worst drought in 40 years, and perhaps the worst ever, depending on how the rest of the season goes. The Amazon's major rivers have reached their lowest level in history. So we're hitting all sorts of records, and we're seeing those images, and we're hearing the stories coming from people who are coming from their communities and talking about this.
To focus our attention on what's going on inside Brazil specifically, Lula visited some areas earlier in the week, and he's got massive challenges in dealing with the situation. What are they?
The challenges are, you know, a huge country, far-flung places to get to. there needs to be more done immediately, more social assistance, more budget for firefighting and for brigades, including Indigenous people's brigades. And then in long term is really stopping deforestation, demarcation of Indigenous lands and local forest communities' lands, better coordination between agencies, and then also between countries. You know, the smoke that's here comes from Peru, but it also comes from Brazil.
Yeah, tell me about that coordination. What kind of coordination is in place already to prevent deforestation? What needs to happen?
So there needs to be more coordination between the forest agencies, but also, you know, between ministries of justice and other agencies that are attacking environmental crimes, as well as the killings of environmental defenders. There is a lot of traffic across the borders. And so that kind of coordination between various government agencies to prevent that from taking place.
The Rainforest Foundation's Christine Halverson. And now, groundbreaking scientific research you might not have known we needed. Proof that pigs can breathe out of their backsides, a military project to create pigeon-guided missiles, and a Europe-wide study which flipped over 350,000 coins to work out the odds. Those projects have all been recognized at the annual Ig Nobel Awards. The awards are a tongue-in-cheek answer to the Nobel Prizes in Sweden and celebrate seemingly absurd but potentially groundbreaking research. Joe Robinson reports from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston.
The day breaks, then your phone breaks. Then your car's brakes start to fail.
The principle that if something can go wrong, it will go wrong, or Murphy's Law, was born from the field of aerospace engineering. The audience at this year's annual Ig Nobel Awards were treated to not just one, but four musical tributes to the concept.
It is again time to perform the rotation of the laureates.
The proudly nerdy organisers invited five Nobel laureates to stand in front of the theatre and spin on the spot, and to hand out 10 prizes to teams from around the world who have made amongst the silliest sounding contributions to science.
The two pigeons are at either end of a small ping pong table.
First, the Ig Nobel Peace Prize was handed out to B.F. Skinner, the pioneering, if controversial, behavioural psychologist. Famed for his work reinforcing behaviour in pigeons, a lesser-known application was his World War II-era initiative to train pigeons to be used to navigate guided missiles.
I want to thank you for finally acknowledging his most important contribution.
Awarded posthumously, his daughter Julie Vargas accepted the award on his behalf.
The ones that were involved with Project Pigeon were in our backyard when I was a little girl. I used to play with them. I have a picture of me holding one of them, actually. You know, it was top secret for so many years. Oh, it was a long time after it was ended that it was actually okay to talk about it. I don't know why. They had radar by then.
In the field of probability, Dutch researchers took the gong for their study, which proved the odds of a coin flip landing on the same side it started were slightly more than 50-50. They learnt this by enlisting volunteers across Europe to flip over 350,000 coins. František Bartoš led the study.
I'm very excited and very happy. I think it kind of highlights the field of statistics that's often forgotten in the field of science.
And how did you find volunteers for this?
Basically, I tried to persuade my friends and my colleagues at the university to spend a day with me before the Christmas and to just spend the whole day flipping coins.
We must succeed in making peace.
One of the highlights of the awards were the winners in the field of physiology. The team from Tokyo Medical and Dental School successfully proved, well,
many mammals are capable of breathing through their anus.
This requires receiving an enema of an oxygenated liquid. While no doubt unpleasant, researchers believe it could have major applications. The team are now beginning phase one trials on humans, and hope the technique could provide an alternative to mechanical ventilation.
COVID-19 puts so much, you know, endangered patients with a respiratory failure condition, so maybe we can provide alternative means to help patients with lung problems.
To cap off the evening, the traditional closing remarks were left to MIT bookstore staff member Barry Duncan.
Goodbye.
Then you get struck by a dump truck. Is it just luck? Just some work.
Joe Robinson in Boston. That caps off the program from us. I'm Celia Hatton. From me and the rest of the team on NewsHour, thanks for listening.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.